Hello, and welcome to another episode of Waves of Change, a Great Lakes Now digital series focused on highlighting the diverse voices shaping the environmental justice movement throughout the Great Lakes region. I'm Anna Seisling, and I'm grateful to you for tuning in. Joining me today is Monica Cady, a member of the Sioux Tribe of Chippewa, who is a forager and herbalist living in Hessel, Michigan, a part of her tribe's ancestral homelands in what is known as the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I begin with Monica talking about environmental justice and what that idea means to her in this moment.
Waves of Change is brought to you by the Fred A. and Barbara M. Erb Family Foundation, the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, Richard C. Devereaux Foundation for Energy and Environmental Programs at DPTV, Polk Family Fund, DTE Energy Foundation, and listeners like you. Thank you.
Monica, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Annie, good to be here. Thank you, Anna.
So, Monica, I want to start with what is pretty a kind of like a big picture question, and also, I don't know, maybe a basic question in some ways, but what does environmental justice mean to you?
I'll just make sure that the next seven generations will have clean air, clean water, and be able to farm the land. So standing up, defending the land, and leaving, I'm going to make sure there's something left for my grandson. So that's environmental justice.
And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about whether or not have you always lived in Hessel? As I said in the intro, I know that that area is part of your tribe's ancestral homelands, but is it a place that you've always resided?
No, I've lived all over. I was born in Flint, Michigan, so I'm very aware of the Flint water crisis, and that's why I'm so concerned about the shutting down Line 5. We certainly do not want to Flint the Great Lakes. I grew up in Flint, and in 10th grade moved to Arizona, and then also lived in California, Hawaii, Minnesota, and North Dakota, and decided to come back home pretty much because everywhere I was living was having drought. So I wanted to come back home to the Great Lakes and also come back to my roots and learn more about Ojibwe culture.
You have told me that you view your work as decolonizing yourself and the land where you reside through plants, through herbalism. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. As I'm learning about culturally significant plants, it's a way for me to learn about my culture. One of my relatives lived to be 113. She's Mackinac Band Ojibwe. And I believe that she lived to be that old from drinking tamarack bark tea and bearberry tea. So by protecting the plants and learning about them, it is my way to decolonize and reclaim and rewild the land and learn what my ancestors ate. So, yes.
You also, though, have talked with me a little bit about this idea of herbalism as environmental activism. And I wonder if you can expand on that idea a little bit more and what that looks like in your work, in your life.
Well, being connected with United Plant Savers is a good example of environmental justice. I suggest everyone check out United Plant Savers. They help people set up botanical sanctuaries. If you have any at-risk plants on your yard, whether it be urban or rural, you can become part of the United Plant Savers Botanical Sanctuary Network. I also asserted that my property is a no-mow zone, and I haven't used gas on my property for 8 years, and I've let it rewild. And as far as environmental justice and herbalism, I forage sustainably, completely sustainably, and for instance, with ramps, I leave the corn in the ground when harvesting, and I've started my own cultivated patch of ramps since they can be decimated really quickly because it takes 18 months for ramp seeds to germinate. So I aim to be very low impact and do everything in season. And basically when I'm foraging, I'm just kind of pruning, going and pruning. You can't even tell that I've been there.
I want to ask you a little bit about what kind of first got you motivated to become involved in environmental justice. But before we get to that,
While we're talking about some of these different plants that you have on your land, I also am really curious and want to make sure that I ask you about the work that you're doing on the Food Sovereignty Committee Board within your tribe.
We're a newly formed committee of 12 Sioux Tribe members. And so we're still getting the bylaws together. And one member wrote a resolution that will basically declare that our reservation boundaries are a no spray zone, like a few other reservations have declared, which I think is extremely important. And it's important because allowing what entities we allow on our reservation boundaries. And that means we don't want anyone spraying glyphosate. And it would be great to be a GMO-free zone, no spray zone. And then, of course, eventually we're going to purchase land. And because our tribe, unfortunately, is very land poor compared to other tribes. And I believe that loss of land equals loss of culture.
You know, you've mentioned these no-mow zones quite a bit in our conversation. Is this something that like you grew up with?
Yes. My Czechoslovakian grandmother, Bubka, had a very, I guess you would call kind of wild yard, a lot of biodiversity, mulberry trees, currants, gooseberries, poppies. Nothing was very manicured. Lots of songbirds. That imprinted on me. And my great-grandmother also made, I would call, medicinal soups with a lot of wild weeds in it, like soup with comfrey and plantain in it. So it imprinted on me, and she inspired a lot of people to garden. And we had a pretty big yard, and when I was just a little kid, some orange hawkweed was growing all around the black spruce, and it smelled like butterscotch, and that was my first declared no-mow zone. I said, "Dad, please let that live," and he did. So then we had a nice colony of orange hawkweed, and I think I've always had a sensitivity to nature. My Ojibwe grandfather, Walt, would take me bird watching. They had 60 acres behind them, and we would go on nature walks a lot. So I think that imprinted. And then when I was 19, I went to the Nevada nuclear test site action, where 1,200 people got arrested, including Martin Sheen. And it was a very big action. I went to my first sweat lodge ceremony, and that's when I learned about environmental racism, environmental genocide. And that's when I kind of got back to my roots, went to my first sweat lodge ceremony.
You told me about this video that was sort of intended to get the spraying on the land Yeah. where you live to stop, an outcome that you were happy with.
For sure. I hope this can inspire other people. My daughter just did a quick video on Earth Day of me walking along the Cloverland power line. They were going to spray Rodeo, which has glyphosate in it. And I was very upset because of the genetic drift pollution from that would have drifted into my yard and, you know, killed the pollinators. And I was mortified. So we just did a quick video, and it actually became viral, and 8,000 people viewed it. So a lot of people agreed and called Cloverland and also attended their meeting and said, "We do not, you know, want cancer-causing glyphosate sprayed, you know, all over." It's a vast area, all of the Cloverland area in the UP. So there was such a public outcry. Cloverland decided not to spray. And they haven't sprayed for 3 years. And then there's going to be another 3 years of not spraying.
You have told me about so many of the plants on your land, plants that you connect with and work with in your herbalism practice. So this next question might be kind of challenging, but I wonder, just for the sake of folks who maybe aren't as familiar with as many plants as you are, if you can talk a little bit, what are maybe three plants that in this moment, in late September, are really resonating with you right now, and how are you working with those plants?
Well, Biba monarda fistulosa is kind of fading, and it's a very special, and it's native to this area. We make tea for it. And when I had COVID, it's definitely what helped me get over my congestion. The leaves are really spicy. And it's called bee balm because it's a bee magnet. I believe everyone should grow it because it's not only medicinal, it's culinary. And The bees love it. The leaf kind of tastes like a spicy oregano. That's one of my favorites. And of course, goldenrod is very showy right now. And there's a myth that it causes allergies. No, it's ragweed, not goldenrod. So please leave your goldenrod. Let it volunteer. It also is very helpful with a UTI, and it makes a delicious golden tea. It's also very important for the songbirds to leave goldenrod, because the songbirds will come and eat the seeds throughout the winter. So that's in the third one. I would say, of course, nettles is a big ally of mine. And nettles I've been eating since early spring, and I've kept it pruned so I can continue to eat it. And a part of food sovereignty, food security, I believe, is growing plants such as nettles that people can forage for, even in an urban setting. I eat nettles every day in one form or another, whether raw in a smoothie, in my rice and quinoa, and I have arthritis, I flog with it. So yeah, nettles, bee balm, and goldenrod right now are three very important ones.
You know, if someone is interested and curious about starting to plant more native plants and protecting local pollinators, where could someone start? What's like a good kind of starting place for somebody who's interested in this, but maybe not super experienced?
I'm really happy with a business organization called upnativeplants.com. They have a wonderful website, and you can buy flats that are, say, pollinator garden, butterfly, monarch way station. So they have flats all organized to start a garden. And they have a very informative website at upnativeplants.com. And I love that their website is neonic free. And then just start with an area that you stop mowing, even if it's small, and let plants volunteer. I've had a lot of native plants volunteer by not over mowing. I've had a lot of asters and goldenrod simply volunteer because I didn't over mow and over manicure. And get an app so you can identify these plants, because sometimes there's so many things people call weeds that aren't weeds. And then, of course, I've mentioned before, check out unitedplantsavers.org. It's very informational.
Monica, in addition to the plants and all of the foraging and the herbalism work that you do, I also know that Line 5 is very close to where you live, and that water protection is another issue that you have spent a lot of time working on and thinking about. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about any of your recent efforts around water protection.
Yes, I live only 1 mile from Lake Huron, and I worry about it every day. I testified last September 8th, Army Corps engineers allowed people to give comments at the Little Bear in St. Ignace, and it went from 2:30 till almost 10 o'clock at night. There was over 200 water protectors that testified, so I was one of them, and basically just, I guess, being vocal about it. I wrote an article recently that's in Red Barn Raising as well, kind of about the racism I witnessed and experienced from Army Corps engineers in Enbridge. So yeah, it needs to be decommissioned and shut down. It's outrageous that it's even, you know, still, it needs to be completely decommissioned and no tunnel. If it were to spill, it would ruin our ancestral lifeways, our whitefish, our food. In a way, Anishinaabe, Ojibwe people, it would have a big impact on our culture.
In hearing you talk about the ways that you have been involved in environmental justice organizing and advocacy, you've been doing this work in so many different ways for a long time. And that being said, burnout is a real issue, I think, in so many different sectors, in so many different ways, for so many different people. But I think especially within environmental justice organizing, burnout can really be a pervasive issue. And I wonder, how do you go about avoiding burnout? In other words, when you're not organizing and thinking so explicitly about your efforts in this part of your life, what are you doing for fun and for joy and to sort of unplug from time to time?
Definitely spending time by the water and going on hikes with my dogs. Went on a hike yesterday and was happy to find gold thread and munched on some wintergreen and feeling the, I guess, nature kind of cleans off my aura and recharges me again. And I like to walk barefoot. That helps. And then gardening, going out and seeing my garden every day, pruning it. That's what gives me hope. Seeing my grandson, who's going to be two, that's what keeps me from getting burned out.
So you've mentioned some organizations and some resources that interested listeners can go and check out if they want to learn a little bit more about you and the work that you do and ways that they can kind of start to get involved in uplifting and protecting native plants where they live. But I wonder, as we close things out, are there any other organizations or mentors or teachers that you would like to mention and share and recommend in this moment for people to just to know about and maybe look into when they can?
Yes, I just recently became acquainted with UPEC, and UPEC stands for Upper Peninsula Environmental Coalition, upenvironment.org or upec@environment.org. They're out of Marquette and Houghton. I've been affiliated with United Plant Savers since 2006 when I was a recipient of the United Plant Savers Native Medicinal Plant Conservation Award and also established a botanical sanctuary on Standing Rock. I love United Plant Savers. They're also a nonprofit grassroots. They offer classes, workshops. Definitely recommend United Plant Savers. And for mentors, I follow Joe Pitawanakut. He's from Wacomicon, Manitoulin Island, and he has a blog called Creator's Garden. I've gone to a few of his classes. He's just amazing. I've learned a lot from him. He's Ojibwe. And of course, Elder Dan Pine Jr. learned from him in Garden River. But yeah, I recommend those few. And of course, oil and water don't mix, all of the organizations for protecting the Great Lakes.
Well, Monica Cady, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you, especially to feature you here in an episode of Waves of Change, a Great Lakes Now digital series. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Miigwech. My pleasure.
Waves of Change is a production of Great Lakes Now and Detroit Public Television. This digital series is produced by me, Anna Seisling, and edited by Jordan Wingrove. Great Lakes Now's executive producer is Rob Green, and Detroit Public Television's vice president of content is Ed Moore.
Waves of Change is brought to you by the Fred A. and Barbara M. Erb Family Foundation, the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, Richard C. Devereaux Foundation for Energy and Environmental Programs at DPTV, Polk Family Fund, DTE Energy Foundation, and listeners like you. Thank you.